You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everyone. This is Tobin Arthur with Innovation for Alpha, and I'm joined today by two incredible guys, and we've got an incredible story to share with you. Will Walker and I have become friends over the last several months, and we're introduced through some mutual friends, and his partner, Dave Koontz. Both are part of Hall Ventures, and which is part of Hall Labs. And I'm going to let them explain the story and the backgrounds, but Dave and Will, welcome, first of all, to the show.
Thanks, Tobin. I appreciate you having us.
Yeah, thanks, Tobin. Always a pleasure.
You bet. Let's start out. Just you guys give us a little bit of background about what you guys have done for your careers, and then maybe tie that to how you got involved with Hall Labs and then subsequently Hall Venture Partners.
Absolutely. So 20-year Wall Street veteran, had early on gotten into entrepreneurship and worked in the CLEC space, but ultimately got to Wall Street and spent about 17 years at three different shops, working in institutional sales. All three places hired as a salesperson, ultimately promoted to run the groups. And really what that allowed me to do was to build long-term relationships with institutions, family offices, and high net worths. And, you know, it was through a family office that was once a hedge fund turned family office that I was really embedded for the last 5 years in the family office space, as he and I built a business together to help families diversify their portfolios by introducing like-minded investors and to really leverage each other's domain expertise. So the idea was really to share in a way which helped diversify risk. And that's how I met the Halls. And, you know, we can talk about the Hall story itself because it's really exciting. But I want to let Will be able to talk about his background a little too here.
Thanks, Dave. Well, I'm Will Walker. I've had a very different, diverse career, starting as a 10, 12-year professional actor, believe it or not. But I morphed into private equity about 28 years ago. So I'm dating myself, but I've been fortunate to be part of a lot of media deals that have been prolific, different asset classes from early days of cable television all the way to, you know, internet, early days of internet, and then, of course, into different private equity investments moving forward. But I'm a big patent and license guy. I'm not an attorney. I do play one on TV years ago, but I'll just make a joke out of that. But I am a big believer in IT and patented technology. And when Dave brought me in and I took a look at the Hall formula and the Hall Labs and the 70-year history, which you'll talk about in a minute, I saw why he had become a managing partner with the Hall Venture Fund and Hall Family Office. So there's so much here in the ESG department and the healthcare world as well that's innovative and patented technology and proven commercialization, as well as certainly addressing big problems and big addressable markets, all the things that I've look for and been fortunate to be part of in different emerging areas. So I'm going to just be quiet now, come back on a little bit. So I'm going to throw it back to you, Tobin, or Dave.
Thanks, Will. And this is going to be one of the best stories that any of you have heard. And I'm really excited to bring this to everybody, because as I've gotten to know what Hall Labs is up to and what's gone on for the last 70 plus years, it's an incredible story. So let's go back kind of to the beginning. And Dave, maybe walk us through how the Hall Labs and the family got all this started.
Absolutely. So the family office was founded by Tracy Hall. Tracy Hall was an innovator. He was a scientist and an entrepreneur. And really, from an early age, his dream was to work at Edison Labs. And he was able to fulfill that dream and worked at Edison Labs in Schenectady, New York, back when it was there. And, you know, he was part of inventing the man-made diamond. So the single crystalline man-made diamond was invented while he was at Edison Labs. He ultimately left there and came to Utah, where he was a professor at BYU. And, you know, they couldn't pay professors very much at that point, but they did let you use their lab space. And he iterated on that and was able to invent the multi-crystalline man-made diamond, which was how the family ultimately created their wealth. That man-made diamond was then sold multiple times to the likes of Schlumberger and Caterpillar and NOV, because they realized that through patented technology, if they built it the right way, it would create a platform. And that platform had the ability to be either licensed through a field of use or sold for a field of use to different companies, whether that's Fortune 1000 or private equity. And they would be able to continue to use that technology over time. And the family would be able to create multiple revenue streams. And to this day, there is licensing revenue coming in from some of those early exits. So it's pretty exciting.
Very cool. We're going to dig more into the labs and to the funds in a second, but I want to touch on the locale story, because at the time, for those that don't know, Provo was not a robust, you know, thriving town and city. It's recently been voted by a lot of different organizations as one of the top places in the country to live and work, but that wasn't always the case. Can you talk a little bit about that and how they invested and basically helped it get to where it is today?
Sure. To your point, Milken Institute just named Provo and Orem one of the best places to do business. And there's a lot of reasons behind that, which I'll get into in a bit. But, you know, as Tracy Hall was looking for a place to build, you know, his vision of what this next iteration of Edison Labs would be, there became a property available that at the turn of the century was the largest employer within the area. And it was called Ironton. And Ironton was a steel mill with three smelters. And as we have about 130 acres that we're on for the campus, and as we continue to grow, we're taking that brownfield and we're reclaiming that land by, you know, fixing it up and capping it off and using it for something that was, you know, at one point unusable. And it's more expensive to do that than to go out and, you know, find regular industrial space. But, you know, that was just, I think, a true testament to kind of what they've chosen to do as a family in their overall vision, as, you know, bringing back to an area that was once thriving and successful and through kind of the Industrial Revolution and then became stagnant. And now through this technology revolution, we're able to bring jobs back in a different format, in a different way.
It's an awesome story. And it ties into a lot of what Hall Labs is about, which, as I've learned about the organization, is about this concept of smart cities and the companies under that. Can you explain a little bit about, you know, what is under the hood? And by the way, in the show notes, we're going to provide links so that folks can see a video of the campus. They can see a lot of different materials, but talk a little bit about what's going on that 130-acre campus today.
Yeah, so when I was fortunate enough to be asked to come and meet the family and see the campus, I walked into, you know, what was this vision that Tracy had. And it was about 550 people on campus. There's 200 engineers and scientists and shared service professionals that are all on this 130-acre campus, including the exited companies that we've had over time. The purchasers have chose to leave those companies in their original spaces because of the value that's created by not only the shared services, but also the shared domain expertise that exists amongst this massive amount of people that really allows us to build and accelerate these patented technologies fast. And so, you know, not only do we build companies quickly, but we kill companies quickly too. And I think that's an important part of the process to understand that, you know, we've learned over 70 years that there's a systematic process to building successful businesses. And you have to be able to approach it that way, where you realize that companies either deserve to be taken to the next level, or oftentimes maybe that technology is put back on the shelf and 10 years later brought back to be used. And there's lots of examples of that.
Well, and there's some incredible companies. We'll talk about a few of those in a minute. Vanderhall, the automotive, which is incredible. Medic, the smart toilet, is a game changer. But let's stick for a second with the theme of smart cities and that overarching, you know, what the thought is there and then how that translates down into some of these specific operations.
Yeah, so that's really our macro view as a family is thinking about what smart city is and what it looks like and what it has the potential to be. So how large industries have the ability to, in many cases that haven't changed in, you know, almost 100 years, that the family looks for big problems and ways to solve things in a much easier and more efficient way. And as the UN has challenged everyone with their sustainable development goals, and everyone is in a race towards net zero, a lot of what we're doing fits in with that overall framework. But, you know, it's not being able to conceptualize smart city means where do you start? And for us, you know, there's not a never ending checkbook, but, you know, the way that we approach it is by building businesses and companies and products that have the ability, like I said, to be in a platform. And that way, through those products and services, they can be purchased by other companies that can help accelerate further growth. But they do all have the ability to symbiotically work together within that smart city environment. And I think that's the important thing to understand is that although we're sector agnostic in terms of the types of businesses that we build, you are going to see tangible technology. Everything that we work on is something you can touch and feel and generally would impact your daily life. But at the same time, there are independent companies. They do work within a single environment.
Well, and from what I've learned, they've really created a system for how to commercialize these companies. I want to get into that in a second. And then we'll touch a bit on the impact part of this story, and that can also tie to the opportunity zone, which is also a big piece of the investment piece. And then we'll talk about the current fund. But let's talk. Maybe just mention. Give people. Let's make it specific. Maybe give a little quick overview of three or four of the companies, so people have a sense of what is under this.
So we'll start with Vanderhall. It's the, you know, probably one of the most commercial of companies that we have. And I think it's important to understand there's a lot of family members that are involved in companies that are on campus, but David Hall, who is Tracy's son, is now in his 70s. He is the patriarch and the one who is driving the innovation process. And Stephen Hall, who is one of his sons, is the innovator behind Vanderhall. But David makes all of his children go out to industry and prove themselves first. So Stephen owned a series of car dealerships, worked closely with Daimler Chrysler, and really built Vanderhall out of his garage. And he knew what he wanted was something that had that old school feel, but had all the modern amenities that we've become accustomed to. And so in building Vanderhall, it was finding a way to build a transportation vehicle, not spend $1 billion doing it, which is traditionally what it's taken to start an automotive company. And so he knew he had to innovate around not only the product, but also the manufacturing process. So we, with Vanderhall, produce everything on campus. Everything's cut out of a single sheet of aerospace aluminum. And the patented technology is in and around how that framework for the vehicle is put together. And then again, how that manufacturing line works. So
those cars are incredible. I've seen them, at least the pictures of them. They're fascinating. From what I understand, there's a wait list for most of them. Is that right?
There is. So the fortunate part is, you know, we haven't had a problem with, you know, demand. The issues have come more around supply chain, and us being able to, you know, to build enough of them. And we just doubled the size of the plant. And happy to say last year, we were able to take the company, became cash flow positive. So, you know, within a 6-year period of time, from start to last year, we built an automobile that no one had ever heard of. And we're able to go to market and create a distribution platform through Indian and Harley Davidson dealerships, and found a big demand amongst that baby boomer community who, you know, really loved their motorcycle, but for one way, shape, or form, started to not feel as comfortable as they used to. And this really filled a hole, and we've been able to sell last year, I think it was a little over 3,000 vehicles. So, and that we're expecting that to double this coming year.
That's cool. And there's a new one coming. It's an electric off-road vehicle that looks incredible. What is it, called the Brawley or something like that?
Oh, it's called the Brawley.
Yeah.
And the original three-wheeler was really our proof of concept. And I'll go back to the platform aspect. You know, the side-by-side will be our next vehicle. And, you know, we are approaching the entire power sports space with electric vehicle. Mm-hmm. So, you know, side-by-side next, there'll be a snowmobile, there'll be an RV, there'll be a boat, and there'll be some urban transportation vehicles. So just exciting things to come out of Vanderhall. And again, multiple revenue streams, ability for strategic partners to come in and help with one or all. Excited to continue to see the growth and, you know, out of what's happening there.
Let's touch on the platform aspect for just a second too. And I want to hit on a couple more of the companies, but sure. Vanderhall, I think, has some exciting things coming here, and, you know, from a financial perspective, there's reasons for investors to get involved now. But you talked about Harley Davidson and Indian as a distributor, and from what I've seen, you know, the organization has, and correct me if this is too simplistic, but basically is understood. They're innovators. They create the technologies, but then instead of building these from start to exit, so to speak, they typically work with big organizations that already have distribution. They're the next level. And they, you know, whether it's through a license or some kind of a relationship, they partner up. And I've seen that in a couple of their other companies. It's really a smart model, but maybe talk about a couple of other examples beyond just the vehicle distribution.
You know, in looking back and in evaluating our process, which I think is something important for everyone to do with their portfolio, we realized that the companies where we brought in a strategic investor at that point of growth, so that growth phase is such an important stage for companies to go through. And we gave a hard look and we realized what we're good at. We're good at building businesses. We're good at patented technologies. And we're good at getting a company to a point of commercialization. What we're not good at, because we just aren't set up that way, is large scale, large distribution, global supply chain. And so when we brought in a partner, and you know, our traditional return on invested capital was around 5.5. And our return on invested capital, when we brought in a strategic partner, went up to 8.3. So, you know, the data and the numbers don't lie. So that really became a huge focus for us, was to apply that same process to other companies. And, you know, I'll give you another example of that. You brought up Medic before. So Medic is a smart toilet. It actually, a lot of the patents around Medic, there are about 150 in total, were created 15 years ago. And that's a perfect example of something that kind of got put on the shelf because The cloud didn't exist. Sensor technology wasn't small enough, but we saw a major shift in healthcare moving from treatment to prevention. And as you know, we look at preventative healthcare, 80% of chronic diseases can be treatable, and they're treatable if they're caught early. So, well, how do you solve that? Don't change human behavior. You know, find something that people have to do every single day and capture the data from that. So we're using AI and machine learning, large data sets for these chronic diseases, and we're able to help individuals monitor their daily health and be able to track it against these massive data sets and look for points of inflection where we're able to tell people, you know, when it might be a good time to go see their physician. And interestingly enough, 43 engineers working on that project in the lab, two gentlemen found out they were pre-diabetic, and a woman found out she was pregnant just by, you know, using the toilet on a day-to-day basis. So,
interesting. There's and all of these stories in the companies are available in the materials that we'll send. So if people want to look at the spectrum, it really is fascinating. But let's talk a little bit about, so the family, the Hall family has funded these operations over the years. They've had some great success with these businesses. But at what point did they start to allow or think about allowing outsiders to co-invest alongside them vis-a-vis the funds? Talk a little bit about how that came to be.
Yeah, so, you know, up to date, this is kind of the first opportunity that individuals have had to invest in the equity of businesses. For 11 years, the family ran a fixed income product, so raised over $125 million, and they paid a 12% coupon. And that never missed a payment in 11 years. And the reason for that was it was tied to some of those early licensing deals. But, you know, it was a way in which the family could share with investors, you know, some of the upside of what they were doing. But we continually got asked the question, why can't we participate in the equity? And, you know, I think, you know, whether it was through the Jobs Act of 2017, but there was a clear desire for other family offices, individuals, high net worths to do more direct deals on their own. But I think there were, you know, there were problems there. And those problems were, how do you source deals? How do you diligence deals? Do you have the internal resources to be able to monitor and make sure you're making the right investments? So this was a risk mitigated way for people to be able to invest directly into companies, knowing that there was a huge family with a 70-year history behind it in innovation and creating companies that, you know, from innovation to exit. And now for the first time, they're allowed to and have the ability to co-invest. And, you know, that was the main reason why I was brought in, was to help build that fund. And I can tell you, it's been, you know, extremely exciting to do that. And, you know, we had about 35 companies to choose from, and, you know, got that down to about 6 that we've made investments in so far. But things change every day. Companies continue to, you know, to grow and commercialize. So we're in no way, shape, or form at a for a lack of deal flow, and kind of who better to be able to make choices on, you know, what companies to invest in than people that were part of building them.
That's right. Super unique in that respect. It's also unique in the fact that the Halls are not only the GPs, but they're also LPs in the fund. So investing alongside everybody.
We're the largest LP as well.
Yeah, that's a pretty good testament right there when they're putting their money alongside everybody and letting them in the door to participate in this. Let's talk. Will mentioned ESG, and there's a lot of impact elements to this, the whole concept of smart cities and bringing technology to these various different categories. But one of the central opportunities is around opportunity zones, and it's something that most people are not familiar with, and we probably don't have time to go into great detail, but in a quick snapshot, what is an opportunity zone? Why is it relevant here, and why is it relevant to the fund investors?
Well, it's funny because we call the fund the, you know, internally, the Anyway Fund. And the joke there is that, you know, we were building the fund to give people the ability to co-invest alongside the family, as we talked, but almost embarrassed to say, we were told we were in an opportunity zone. So we get a call from the town of Provo, and they told us that we were in one of the census tracts that qualified for opportunity zone investment. And, you know, what that meant is that we now had a tax advantaged vehicle for people to invest in. And so it allows people to take capital gains, defer paying taxes on those capital gains to the end of 2026. And I think that changes, but we'll see. And what a lot of people don't realize, when you say opportunity zones, 99% of the people that I talk to think it only applies to real estate. And that's partly because the first set of regulations only dealt with real estate, but operating businesses qualify for opportunity zone investments as well. And venture investing obviously has a very different ability to for returns than traditional real estate investing. And but you know, this was a massive undertaking by the Fed to roll out the opportunity zone guidance and incentives. And to date, it's I believe the number is a little over $16 billion that's been committed to opportunity zone projects. And we're thrilled to be one of the only ones that are doing it exclusively within the operating business space. So it really was put together as a way to provide capital to domestic emerging markets, as Cory Booker likes to call them, and invest back into, you know, businesses in real estate that are in areas that were depressed for one reason or another and now are starting to thrive again.
That's pretty cool. And let's relate that to the fund and maybe start to talk a little bit about some of the specifics of the fund. How large is the fund? What are the closing plans for the fund? And what types of investors are you looking for and have typically been participating in the fund? Just give us some of the high level here.
We launched the fund last month on the 15th, and the fund will be open through the end of the year. So it'll be about a 6-month period to raise. Although based upon, you know, kind of early interest, I don't anticipate it to last that long. And we have a combination of investors that have been high net worths, family offices, and really you have to be an accredited investor in order to invest within the fund. But the people that have seen real value in what we're doing are frankly other entrepreneurs and people who have capital gains. But there's about a 70-30 split in the fund between people who are using capital gains to invest versus people who are just looking for a regular growth venture opportunity. So I think that's a testament to the type of fund and the businesses that are within that fund, because the Opportunity Zone program doesn't make a deal good or doesn't make a deal better. It's just kind of this tailwind that helps an already existing quality investment.
Yeah, that makes sense. And are there minimums that you're looking for in the fund, or?
There's a $500,000 minimum within the fund. Okay. We have had some flexibility. So I would encourage anyone who has interest. We're always looking for people that want to be involved. If they want to be more than a check, we're arms wide open. We'd love for people to bring their history and their domain expertise to be part of accelerating these businesses. And many people have helped dive in and brought their networks to the table, or, you know, their career path, to help build, what's already there.
Will, why don't you just jump in and kind of bring us full circle, wrap us up, and talk about next steps for people that have an interest. Obviously, we're going to put all the information in the links, but there is a sense of urgency from the standpoint of the fund's moving quickly. People are getting involved. There are also some underlying things in the fund, sure, companies that are looking to have some success here pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Tobin. We've been very gratified to see the acceptance of the fund and of the single issue opportunities that each of these portfolio companies in this diverse fund, you know, present. And we've had, I would say, probably out of a $25 million fund, which is just kind of a continuation fund of our first venture fund. So it's not a big fund. And we've got about half committed to right now. And it's only been open for a little over 3 weeks, I guess, not even that. So we are moving fast. We have a number of exciting updated exit potentials, which, you know, I'm not going to talk about on a group call, but would love to bring anyone that's interested to have a discovery call with Dave or myself and kind of find out some of the exciting things that are going to be considered historic in both the public markets and the private markets. One of the things that really got me is when I went up and really looked through this whole and met all the CEOs in the portfolio companies is the average historic time frame is 2 to 4 years for Hall to have public and private exits for all of their many, you know, past exits. They've had four and recently, all of them over 100 million, two over 200 million. So they have a very good track record, and that's in a very short period of time, all tax advantage, like Dave said. And certainly we have some that are even imminent in a fast track way sooner than that. So for anyone out there that has interest in, you know, in learning more and getting really an updated look, I do encourage everyone to take a virtual tour through the campus. There'll be a link provided. And, you know, and then book a call with myself or Dave Koontz. There'll be information there. I know Tobin and Angel MD have been a great proponent of Hall, and just like HUD and EIG and all the big think tanks, federal and local, have been, because we have created so many jobs, 3.5 million jobs we've created out there with our companies, current and past companies that Hall has produced. So please take advantage. I would love to talk to you, and certainly we'll be standing by to update some very exciting things that, you know, any investor of any class would certainly want to know about and take advantage of moving forward. So hopefully that helps, Tobin.
Thanks, Will. And Dave, I'll just give you the floor. Any wrapping comments, anything that we missed that you want to hit on?
Yeah, no, I would just to iterate on kind of what Will said. There are strategic investors on campus every day. And, you know, part of the reason why we're such proponents of the, you know, building patents early is it gives us the ability to open our doors to share with, you know, those large PE and Fortune 1000 companies who have come to expect and oftentimes come on a regular basis to see what's next. And, you know, since that has started to become part of a process for these businesses, it's exciting for us at Hall Venture, because it just means that, as Will said, there's exciting things coming down the pipe as the potential for those partnerships and those exits come to fruition.
Well, Dave and Will, I appreciate you guys coming on the show and spending some time today. I love the Hall Labs story. It is the modern Edison Labs, which anybody who has followed the Edison story, it's an incredible one. And it's fun to see the modern version of that and all that's going on there. And the individual companies are quality companies. Everybody I meet that's associated with the organization are high quality. And so it's a lot of fun to feature what you guys are up to. And we wish you a ton of success. We'll have you back on to talk more about specific companies and some of the outcomes. I mean, there's so many different stories here, but I appreciate you getting it started today.
Well, we can't thank you guys enough for the continued support, and look forward to coming back on. So thanks so much, Tobin.
Wonderful, Tobin. Thanks again for you and Mike and everybody, your whole team, you know, has been great. And I know we're going to do some big things together. So
thanks. Appreciate it.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by Angel Indie Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.